Good evening. This is WFIU. The program is Profiles, and I'm Bob Willard. The music you're hearing is sung by our guest, Carol Lawrence, the original Maria in West Side Story. Carol was in Bloomington to participate in the Leonard Bernstein tribute in April of 1999. A few days before flying out, she talked to us by phone from her home in Los Angeles. Last week, we heard the first part of this interview. Tonight, we listen to the second half. You were quite young when you were in New Faces.
Yeah.
And you must, when did you recognize your love affair with musical theater?
I was about six, and I was, by that time, studying dance, and I heard, I watched every musical comedy that came along. I saw Singing in the Rain and fell in love with tap dancing and Gene Kelly in that order, and knew that I wanted to be on the boards, on Broadway, singing and dancing like Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor in the movies. That's what inspired me. I'd never seen a Broadway show. I lived in Melrose Park, Illinois, outside of Chicago, and the first production I went to in Chicago was a ballet. So my training began as a dancer, and the dichotomy of my auditioning for Jerry was Robbins was that he never allowed me to show him that I could dance. I only auditioned as a singer-actress, and I would always say at the end of every one of those 13 auditions, and I also dance, Mr. Robbins. He'd say, yes, dear. And would not, you know, so when the ballet came to being staged, I went to him again with the guts of a giant and said, because he was going to put two other dancers in like they did in Oklahoma. In the ballet, that was the tradition. They didn't never figured that the singers who were singing opera in West Side could dance. And in truth, Larry was not a dancer. He was a stunt man in Hollywood. So he rode horses, and he did gymnastics in high school, and he had the strength of a lion, but he did not have the finesse of a ballet-trained dancer. I had danced all my life, and on point, and on, you know, tap dance, all kinds of dancing. So I asked Jerry Robbins if we could learn the pas de six, the beginning of the ballet. And he very reluctantly said, well, get in the back and learn it. And we did. And suddenly, because we wanted to do it more than anybody, we were doing the lifts higher. We were jumping fast. I mean, it was obvious that we had to do it. And that was one of the distinct qualities that made our show unique, was that everybody sang and danced the whole show. So that was how I got to do the ballet.
Well, actually, so you were 6 years old and you decided you wanted to be in musical theater. What training did you give yourself or did you get? Who were your mentors, et cetera?
I began, like every other little kid in the neighborhood, in the local dance studio, and I learned to tap dance. First of all, my teacher was a tap dancer, and when I had learned as much as I could from her when I was in the eighth grade, I went downtown to the Loop to what I was told was the best dance studio. And it took an hour to get downtown, but she was on Michigan Avenue. It was Edna McCrae's School of the Dance in the Fine Arts Building. I felt so elegant. And I auditioned for a scholarship. And I did, I had a wonderful technique in tap, not a good one in ballet, but I was 12 years old, and I won the tap scholarship, which put me in the advanced tap class and the beginner's ballet class because my technique was so poor. So here I was 12 years old with 7-year-olds and 12-year-old with 30-year-olds, professionals from the Chicago Theater performing in Chicago. So it was a very strange dichotomy in my relationship with Edna McCrae because I was the only one who could learn numbers from the professional tap dancers and note them on paper and teach them slowly to Edna McCrae, who was a very poor tap dancer, so that she could teach them to her young tap dancers. So here I was teaching my teacher the things she didn't know, and then she was imparting to me ballet training from the Cecchetti method, and, I mean, real. She was trained in Russia. She was Scottish. And the disciplinary, I mean, she made Jerry Robbins look like Mary Poppins.
So you were prepared.
I was prepared for Jerry Robbins could not shock me, and I think that's why we got along so well. He did love me. I'm told by Arthur Lawrence, he shamed me so terribly one day because I was in the ballet. But the ballet was the only thing in Washington, D.C. that got any kind of critique in our reviews. The rest of the show was raved about in the review. And we, by the end of the first day in the box office, we were totally sold out. There's a picture of Lenny outside of the National Theater in Washington, D.C. in his white suit, skipping. The most ecstatic, happy, joyful shot. It's the shot that ends my lecture, because it's Lenny as I knew him, as this angel who just enjoyed life so fully. He lived the lives of about six people. He was a concert pianist, the conductor of the Philharmonic Orchestra in New York City, a composer par excellence, who did opera and ballets and symphonies, and considered an acting career, and traveled the world as guest conductor, and was the teacher of all times at Curtis and a thousand places, because his joy was building new talent and giving them the wings to fly. And he did that for us in West Side, because we were the first people directed by Jerome Robbins, who had only been a choreographer, and the complete relationship of choreographer and corps de ballet is of master and slave. And the more a choreographer denigrates and humiliates a dancer, the tougher and the more rebellious they become to prove him wrong. I will show you that I can do that. And it works. I mean, a dancer can pull all of that adrenaline into his body and leap higher, turn faster, do what that master told him he couldn't do. But as a director, Jerry had never tried. I mean, he did that same method by humiliating an actor, telling them they had absolutely no talent, you stupid ass. I don't want it. Don't, get out of my face. And well, now you can't turn around and be what he asked you, more poignant or just more revealing of whoever this Romeo and Juliet giant characters, complex characters. And so we would walk out of or be dismissed from a rehearsal with Jerry Robbins, alone with maybe Larry and me, and we would walk out bleeding emotionally. And Lenny would be there at rehearsal, literally, put his arms around us and say, come on, let's work on the balcony scene. And we'd say, but we don't have a pianist. They're all working. You know, we always had two pianos going at one time. He said, well, we'll find a piano. I'll play for you. And I have pictures of him literally doing that. He patched us back together, bound our wounds, and he would take my face in his hands and say, oh, that's so beautiful. I never knew it could sound that good. But if it doesn't feel good in your mouth, tell me, because I'll change it. Well, you don't want him to change a single note of that perfection. And you would kill yourself to please him because he loved you. He loved you into it. He didn't beat you into it. And so I really credit him with saving our souls to perform on the stage. I mean, we were being beaten up around the clock by Jerry.
And hence the love letter to Lenny.
That's what it's about, yes. Yeah.
Well, we've been touching on the stage a lot here, but you have a fairly extensive career in both motion picture and television, too.
Yes.
And let's not overlook that.
Okay.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you've done there?
West Side was such an incredible springboard for me, because we were the toast of the town. Here were these teenagers running around, you know. We were literally challenged by gangs. Not me, but the boys, because they felt we were so honest in the portrayal that they thought it was a real gang up there. And they were challenged to a rumble. A gang literally came backstage one day and said, well, we want to take you on, see if you're so good. And because we were a hit, I was allowed to go on television. And on the Sullivan Show, I did about 17 Sullivan shows. And by the end of our run, I was then doing specials with Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor and Maurice Chevalier and Bing Crosby and all of the giants of this business, Sid Caesar. And you'd do learn. You learn best of all, not in a class, but in production, working face-to-face with these people. I was then cast as Catherine in A View from the Bridge, which was directed by Sidney Lumet. He and I had done two Play of the Weeks, The Dybbuk, which is my favorite television experience of my life, that incredible classic Yiddish play we did with music, with special music, and Anna Sokolow doing the choreography and literally taking on the soul of another person and speaking with their voice. The Dybbuk is such an incredible piece. I also did Rashomon with Sidney Lumet as a Play of the Week and got to play all those different versions of Everybody's Truth. And I went on to do every possible guest television, from the game shows to, the Dean Martin and the Gary Moore and the Telephone Hour and the U.S. Steel and the Hallmark Playhouses. It was the golden age of television, the likes of which we now have in 85,000 cable, but it's all mixed with pornographic slutty stuff, and I don't consider this a golden age. But that's my opinion, and we're in another field.
You even
now.
Did General Hospital for a while, didn't you?
I did. I was Angela Eckert. And the joy of doing a soap opera, Bob, is that you are known across the board by every piece of society. Everybody from doctors, get addicted. They have the flu one day, and they begin watching, and then they put in their tapes every day and get to keep current. Doctors and college students and housewives in supermarkets. I'd be shopping in a supermarket and somebody comes and says, Angela's here! Do you see Angela? I became another person. I said, oh, no, I'm not Angela. I know who you are, I know, but I love the way you told Tracy off. You really put her in her place. Good for you! They think you are living this person's life. And it was wonderful. I loved it. It was heaven.
You also did a fair number of murder she wrote, as I...
Yeah, I did about 8 of those. I was a recurring character on Murder One. I played a Barbara Walters character that just sliced you to pieces on the air. Reveal these things she promised never to say about a murder suspect. So it's been fun. I love playing villains. I am currently going back to Australia. They've made me a recurrent character on the new series being made of Flipper.
You're not doing Flipper.
No, I'm not doing Flipper. I was saved by Flipper. I've already done one. And I'm this feisty anti-MAME character who does everything that people tell her not to do. And I went scuba diving to get a picture for my granddaughter in the play. And I get stuck underneath her. I can't find my way out. And I'm out of air. And Flipper has to rescue me. Well, so he pulls me out by a dorsal fin pull toe.
Well, thank you, Flipper.
Thank you, Flipper. They are fabulous. So they have they've written two more episodes for me to come back next month. I go back to Australia, and I'm doing two romantic episodes where I fall in love with a gentleman who has left a message in a bottle, and it reads, the beautiful woman who reads this note has now been proposed to by me. And I won't tell you anymore, except that we do fall in love. He's a handsome man, and... I won't tell you the ending, because it really will tell your heart apart.
Okay. Well, and you're also an author. You have a book.
I have two books.
Oh, two.
I wrote my autobiography. It was the last one done by McGraw-Hill, and it's called Carol Lawrence, The Backstage Story.
Okay.
And it just chronicles my life from the time I started tap dancing in Melrose Park to right now. In whatever I'm doing, one has to keep reinventing themselves, I had my own television show for 3.5 years on the Trinity Broadcasting Network. I don't know if you know about that.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about the show, but I know.
You didn't know about it. But it was a half-hour magazine format, the likes of the Mike Douglas show that Rosie O'Donnell has now copied. I was doing 3.5 years before on TBN, which is a Christian network. So it didn't reach, 20 billion people. It only reached 20 million. But it was cooking and interviewing celebrities, people who have really surmounted a giant obstacle in their life, and to determine how they did it and how they're surviving in today's chaotic world. and it had singing, it had nutrition and a diet and exercise. I interviewed Robert Pritikin from the Pritikin Center and his chef and his head exerciser and the Fifth Dimension and John Schneider and Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. and Rosie Greer, a lot of wonderful Christian people, Pat Boone, and it was tremendously successful, but I had to write it, direct it, not direct to camera, but produce it, do all the pre-interviews, buy all the food, figure out all the menus, figure out all the exercise, and I literally could not carry on the rest of my life, so I'm not doing that one anymore. Well, but I'm working on a new one.
A new book or a new show?
A new television show, and it's aimed at people over 50 who are making the second half of their life better than the first.
Good. I can
read
that.
It's a demographic that is being totally ignored by the media, and I think it's high time we folks who have figured out that it's really okay to get older and you don't have to stop functioning or producing. You can just get better.
And there's also I Remember Pasta.
Ah, you did remember. Yes, that's a salute to my mama, my Italian mama, who was the greatest chef that ever lived, gourmet. She could evolve in 10 minutes a feast without any warning for 6 to 8 people, dinner, without batting an eye. I mean, she had a pantry of canned goods that she put together that always assured her of a complete meal on 10 minutes notice. And she gave her recipes complete to nobody but me. So that's what I wrote. I know in heaven she's looking down and frowning because my sons are furious with me that I gave away her secrets. But I think they should not die with me or should not have died with her.
So now you've shared them with the world.
With the world. Plus, the book is full of funny anecdotes about the celebrities for whom I cooked her specialties as a way of thanking them. I cooked for Leonard Bernstein. I cooked for Gene Kelly and Bing Crosby and Bob Hope and Mickey Rooney. I made ravioli because opening night when I replaced Ann Miller in Sugar Babies, she had broken her foot, and I was put in the show in 4 days. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I was so nervous, Bob, to try to remember all the lines and all the staging and all the steps that I was ready to make my entrance, and Mickey Rooney, whom I absolutely adore, came from the preceding sketch, which he closed in his long red underwear. We're doing burlesque, a takeoff on burlesque. He came in the wings in the dark, and I'm perched on this cart of luggage being pulled by 4 red caps onto the train station. And I'm going to sing, I feel a song coming on, right? And I'm in all these feathers, praying that I remember the steps in the dark. And he tugs at my shoulder. He says, I'm going to introduce you, kid, okay? And he ran in his red underwear in front of this careening luggage cart, yelling at the audience, okay, Toronto, I want to hear a welcome. Do you know who's here? It's Carol Lar. Well, the audience, you know, was thrilled. The orchestra broke up. The boys wet their pants. I was laughing so hard at him. This little red thing running in front of me looked like a Cupid doll in long underwear. He is so funny. And, well, it broke the ice. I couldn't be nervous anymore. This number stopped the show. He gave me a curtain speech my mother should have written. And at the end of it, I ran to his dressing room, and I said, Mick, Italians say thank you with food. What would you like me to cook for you? And he said, ravioli. Well, ravioli, you got to start with dough, and you have to make spaghetti sauce. I mean, it's a big Michigan thing to do. I said, okay. As soon as I can do it, Mick, you got it. So the next night, he's at my dressing room knocking at the door. He said, where is it? I said, what? He said, the ravioli you promised me last night. So you promised, where? I said, Mick, I'm in a hotel room. I don't even have a hot plate. You want ravioli? He said, then don't promise me what you can't deliver, kid.
You got
every
it?
Sketch we did, every number from that time on had something about ravioli in it. As the school marm, I would say, Mickey, why are you late for school? He said, well, I didn't have any breakfast. And he said, you can't get any ravioli for breakfast around here. You know that. And the audience didn't know what he was talking about. But the cast would break up. I would break up. And I finally realized that I had to fix him ravioli. So San Antonio or Houston or somewhere, I found a restaurant that a friend, my hairdresser knew the owner of, and they were dark on the same night we were. I rented the restaurant and the kitchen. I employed all of the showgirls to chop garlic and parsley. I made a cauldron of spaghetti sauce, because by now, the entire orchestra, the cast, the wardrobe, the crew, knew about that I was fixing ravioli for him. Well, I had to fix spaghetti. I didn't make ravioli for the entire, because I had, I guess there must have been almost 100 people for dinner. But I made ravioli for Mickey Rooney. And the chapter in the book is Mickey Rooney Ravioli, and then you get the story and the recipe. So that's what the book is. It's a comic cookbook, is what it is, with the greatest recipes. And it's available on HSN. I went on and sold out all but 99. They kept 99 so that, you know, if they have any kind of returns, they would be able to refund if they got damaged in the mail or something.
Mm-hmm.
So if anybody's interested, they can call HSN, and it's called I Remember Pasta. And if they sell the 99, they will give me my commission on it.
Okay.
I'd love to say, we're totally sold out. When I went on the air, the producer turned to me, and, you know, I get 9 minutes to pitch the bloody thing, and they said, you're sold out. I said, really? Great, because there were 2,000 books. And so now when we're talking, I was talking to them about where is my check, you know? They said, oh, well, we didn't sell out. I said, then why did you say you sold out? Oh, well, we always say that, because there might be somebody left, you know, once you go off the air and they're still on the phones. So they have 99.
Okay.
All right.
Maybe they won't have that many when the show's over.
When this show is over, because they're all autographed. They're all personally autographed. And I will send you one, because I have some, of course, in my garage that I send to people whom I love.
Well, that's enough to heat me up. Let's listen to some music now. You had suggested the overture to Candide.
It's my favorite of his overtures.
Well, let's hear it, conducted by the composer Leonard Bernstein.
Perfect.
We have just heard the overture to Candide, written, conducted, and performed by Leonard Bernstein.
Yes.
And we are here with our guest, Carol Lawrence, the original Maria of West Side Story, a very active person in television, stage, theater, and she's with us visiting over the phone, so
right.
If it sounds a little different.
Yes.
Now, Carol said she had another story she wanted to share with us. So.
There are, you know, if we had 6 or 7 hours, the stories out of performances in West Side Story are so remarkable, because the intensity with which we performed had not been seen. And I've never seen it since that could match it. And perhaps that's because I was so close to it and I loved everybody on stage so very much. We had a love and a respect for what we were doing that came out of 3 months of rehearsal and working with geniuses, the likes of Leonard Bernstein, Jerome Robbins, Stephen Sondheim, Hal Prince, Bobby Griffith, who was the older of the producers and perhaps the wisest of producers, because it was his decision to take West Side Story when Cheryl Crawford, a wonderful and successful producer, said, I don't think you got a prayer, folks, and I can't get behind this, so I'm leaving so I don't stand in your way, because I don't think you got it. So we were so young, and the strength of it was that nobody ever could break up in the show. I mean, if you broke up and Jerry Robbins saw you, you were dismissed. you were just fired. It was over. Because he always had three understudies. I always had three understudies. And he just would not put up with it. So one night, I was doing the very last death scene with Larry Kurt, just as he runs into my arms in the very last scene, and you think we are safe, he is shot, and we both fall to our knees, knowing that he's dying. And I cradle him in my arms, and he looks straight up into my face, leaning way, way back, and he says, Maria, we're not going to make it. And I lean over him, and I say, no, Tony, there's a place for us. And as I was singing, as usual, I was crying. But this particular night, if you can picture this, the tear rolled down my cheek and went right up his nose. Well, I've never seen a look on anybody's face. Like, I mean, Larry was the quickest breakup anyway, and we were so close that we could break each other up just by wiggling an ear or anything. And I knew he was going to start laughing out loud. Well, after the show, he said, you know, I could see it coming, and it was the biggest tear I ever saw, and I couldn't get out of the way. It went right up my nose. He said, once it got up my nose, I felt like I was drowning. So he did this. He started to cough in my arms. Well, nobody in the audience could see the tear go up his nose. It was just between Larry and me. So knowing that if we both broke up in the death scene, we would both be fired. I clutched him to my chest, Bob, with the ferocity of a gorilla. I had him buried in my bosom. And I forgot. I knew this, but I forgot that Larry, in real life, had claustrophobia. He couldn't even put on a turtleneck sweater without doing the St. Vitus dance. So now he's in my arms, and he's struggling to get out because he, first of all, he can't stand it. He's drowning, and he's got claustrophobia. So we struggled. We went back and forth. It looked like he was in the throes of death. And I did not let go of him until he stopped struggling because I figured he's either suffocated or he's over this claustrophobia nonsense. And I put him down on the floor, and you have never seen a happier corpse in your life. His eyes were closed, but he was grinning. He couldn't stand. It was hysterical. And because my back covered him, you know, the entire cast is on the stage. They didn't know what was happening because I usually went on singing longer. Suddenly, I had stopped singing, and we are wrestling. The cast were like, I turned to them, and their eyes were saucers. I could not believe, and so I had to gain control. But we had in the Rumble one night, George Marcy, who was playing Bernardo, compound fractured his femur. That's your thigh bone.
Uh-huh.
That's the largest bone. And he was writhing on pain. He was supposed to be dead, but he was on the floor. He was moving, which is against the rules, and nobody's supposed to touch him. And he said, help me. Get me off stage. You know, he's talking upstage. Nobody would come near him. He swore he had to curse and say, get me off this blanking stage. I have broken my leg. And they finally brought the curtain down. Could you believe that?
No,
I mean, that is the kind of electrifying performance that the audience saw. I mean, opening night of West Side Story in Washington, D.C., at the end of the death scene where they're carrying his body off and I'm following, you know, in a veil of tears with this black shroud over me, there's just one bell and the strains of somewhere place for us, there's a place for us. The curtain falls very slowly. We rush to our places at the footlights for the curtain call. Curtain rises. We look out at the audience. They look back at us. We stared back at them, and I thought, dear God, they hate it. They were right. Cheryl Crawford was right. They don't get it. It's a flop. And then, as if they were choreographed by Jerome Robbins, they leapt to their feet, screaming and yelling and pounding their feet. I mean, I burst into tears again because it was so real. They were so stunned that we had killed Tony, that we had literally killed the leading man in a musical comedy. They didn't know how to take it. And then they realized what beauty there was and what truth and the message of the whole play. And by the end of the 29th or 35th curtain call, Lenny had worked his way backstage, and he was in the wings. And he walked to the center stage, put his arms around me, and we both wept. We both just wept. And that was the power of West Side Story, and that's why it's still being done all over the world. That's the joy of being in a legendary classic, and I am so grateful that I was a very small part of that incredible masterpiece.
Well, it's a story that transcends the story and becomes bigger
than
life. It
does. It really, really does.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'd just like to ask one last question.
Sure.
Before we finish. Actually, it's going to be a two-part question.
Okay.
One is, how do you balance, did you balance a family life in the performing arts with all the travel?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have lived such a rich and full life.
Yeah.
What philosophies have you developed that have helped you be your guide and have such longevity on the stage?
Wow.
Well, the first question's about the family.
Right. And I have to say, it would take me an hour to explain all the mistakes I made and how many times I have repented of, you know, I was married to Robert Goulet,
mm-hmm.
and we had two thriving careers. I became pregnant almost as soon as I finished my nightclub commitments, which was about 4 or 5 months after we were married. I became pregnant with our first boy, Christopher, and then almost immediately, 4 months later, became pregnant, not wanting to become pregnant, but unfortunately, and this is all in my book, I got a wonderful review in the same show with Robert Goulet, Carousel, and he was blasted, and he decided I should be pregnant and off the stage, off his stage, that I was too much competition. And I still love Robert Goulet, and unfortunately, the biggest problem in the marriage, and it wasn't that we both had careers, and it wasn't that we both had the pressures, those all add up, the press conferences, the two sets of managers, and two sets of agents, and two sets of secretaries, three houses, three poodles, two babies, staff for days, traveling, separations, opening nights, press conferences, being in a goldfish bowl all your life and being scrutinized by the press, who are the most unkind, unfair, for that critic to say that I was good and my husband, whom he knew is my husband, didn't deserve to be on that stage. I mean, what did he think he incited in our family, let alone in Bob's career? Unfortunately, the thing that broke everybody's back was that Bobby was addicted to alcohol. And I'm sure had that not been a part of the entity, he would not have felt that way. He would not have lost control and, you know, insisted that I become pregnant and off of his stage. I mean, that was his only weapon. That is a tragedy in itself. From then on, I wish I could say that I coped with it, and that, I mean, I had never known an alcoholic. Italians don't have alcoholics in their families. They either beat them up and they stop drinking, or they dismiss them. So I knew nothing of the pattern. And in the late 60s, which this was, you didn't talk about alcoholism because that stopped your career cold. So nobody could talk about it. All I did was become the greatest codependent that ever lived. I enabled him to continue his career. I lied and covered everything up. I made it possible that my children grew up in a completely dysfunctional home. And I didn't know that I was crippling them. I thought I was saving their father for them because I was brought up in an old-world Catholic background, and divorce was not a part of my vocabulary. You just didn't divorce them. You didn't leave until it got too dangerous to stay. I mean, it got very violent, and my children were then in the position of wanting to protect me, and I couldn't allow that. So another time that he left, his pattern was to leave, and then I would beg him to come back, and then he would come back, and we would try again. And I finally decided that I couldn't ask him to come back. And we started 4 years of a giant litigation, and it ended up with a reconciliation that didn't work, and 7 days later, my father died of cancer. 6 months later to the day, my mother died of a heart attack. And 3 days after her funeral, I had to be on a symphony concert stage because we were totally sold out and they would have sued me. Well, the depression that I fell into was enormous. I couldn't stop crying. If I were on stage, Bob, and I had the words and the lyrics and the tap dancing, I could get through it. And people said, "You're so strong." And they never saw the nights alone in the hotel room where I couldn't stop crying. And I finally turned my life because I couldn't breathe. I got to where the babies get when they can't stop crying. And I turned to my faith and I said, "Jesus, you told me that you would never give me a burden I couldn't carry, and I'm drowning. And I guess I have to turn this, my entire life, over to you because I'm not running it." And that's what I did. And the tears stopped, and I could breathe again, and a peace entered my heart, the likes of which I hadn't known from childhood, and I knew that I never, ever had to be alone again. And that's what's pulled me through.
Carol, I thank you for trusting us enough to tell us that story.
Well, you know, it's impossible. That's why I wrote my book. It's impossible to tell parts of it and to skim over like they do in talk shows and say, "Well, it was really very hard, yes, but, you know, we get through it, and life, that's life." It certainly is life. But where do you get the stamina? Where do you get the guts to stand up and face it? And I don't think we do that well alone. I think somewhere a spiritual core needs to be the center of your being. And whether it's Buddhism or Mohammed, whoever, for me it's Jesus Christ and Christianity, and that has been the answer.
Tell us about, you have the two boys.
Yes.
What are they doing?
My sons are Christopher and Michael Goulet, and they are currently my best friends. And a lot of mothers say that. And there is an Italian tradition of mother and son that is almost incestuous. You know that. I mean, Sophia Loren and her sons are the picture of beauty and love. And there is a passion that comes with being Latin. Now, my kids are French-Italian, so they get it. You know, the Latin is there. And Michael is the best chef that I know next to my mama, and has been on my television show. He was my resident chef, and we cooked together and argued over, you know, "That's a little bit too much. Oh, no, don't do that. Don't put pineapple on that pizza. I hate it." And he brings the generation gap, you know, into full bloom in the kitchen for me. We cooked a cauldron of spaghetti yesterday together, and we're going to have dinner tonight. Christopher, Michael is a singer, and has worked in my symphony concerts and on cruise ships with me and various places. He's working on his own act. He has a brilliant baritone voice. He has sung Mordred to his father's Arthur in Camelot to fabulous reviews. He does this with a Scottish brogue. And he's so evil, nobody believes that he's the sweetheart that he is in real life. And Christopher is a computer whiz. He's working on his graphic computer skills right now and studying Avid editing, whatever that means, because I have a simple computer, and turning it on and writing a letter and going into the web, internet, is about as far as I want to get. But Christopher is going to be an animated artist one day. He also composes beautiful music, and he has a fabulous baritone voice. They're both tremendously talented, but as you can tell, I'm not proud of them at all.
No, I wouldn't have guessed that.
I'm the original Italian mama. I could go on an hour just about them.
Our guest today has been Carol Lawrence, best known as the original Maria in West Side Story. But we've heard a lot more than that today. And, Carol, we can't thank you enough for taking the time from your busy schedule to be with us.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and I don't say that lightly, Bob. You are perhaps the best interviewer I have ever worked with, and that's 40 years.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, why don't we end in your request with the second movement, from the Chichester Psalms of Leonard Bernstein, and this is the one based on the 23rd Psalm. And it's broken into in the middle, you'll notice, with some very loud part where it says, "Why do the nations rage?" But the 23rd Psalm wins.
Okay. I couldn't think of a better way to end.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
And it's been wonderful.
My pleasure.
Okay. This is Bob Willard. You are listening to Profiles. The station is WFIU, and we can't thank you enough for spending the time with us this evening.
I enjoyed it.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in April of 1999. Christina Kuzmich, producer. Engineering and editing by Michael Paskash and John Shelton. For WFIU, thanks for listening.